She is an Israeli feminist, a lecturer in women's studies at Cal State University in Monterey Bay. You might ask why ask her to be the introducer of tonight's speaker. It's not only because of her peace activism, but for a very specific purpose. Sadly, much of the discussion about issues of Israel and Palestine are far, far removed, sometimes dramatically removed, oftentimes it appears purposely removed, from the daily sufferings of the Palestinian people, laboring under occupation and siege for nearly four decades now, and the further suffering and degradation of the Israeli people who are paying the heavy price that is paid by all occupiers, as we're learning as a country ourselves. Dalit Baum has had firsthand experience of these realities, and as an Israeli citizen and as a person involved in efforts to oppose the occupation, she's been very deeply involved in the nonviolent struggles to oppose the security barrier of Israel when it's been encroaching on Palestinian lands, an encroachment which results in the expropriation of still more land, still more water. Not only does it render tens of thousands of Palestinians economically destitute, but it also makes moot the question of a two-state solution. So Dalit Baum is in a unique position to introduce our speaker tonight, and I think you will agree with me that she deserves a very warm welcome as she introduces our speaker. Thank you for being here.
I cut it short.
Thank you very much. When Scott asked me to come here tonight and introduce Dr. Finkelstein, I was very pleased and happy. And then he said in his characteristic candor that he wants me here because I'm an Israeli. So I practiced my accent, and I will use it heavily. But seriously, it is very, very disturbing and a little weird that we need all these justifications in order to listen to a person like Norman Finkelstein, who is a world-renowned scholar in the field of studying the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He has written five books, The Rise and Fall of Palestine, A Personal Account of the Intifada Years, A Nation on Trial, The Goldhagen Thesis and Historical Truth, Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, and his recent book, Beyond Chutzpah, on the Misuse of Anti-Semitism and the Abuse of History. Relating again to this question of justification and legitimation of speakers, I have the same exact experience coming to this country speaking as an Israeli, because I come here and I'm an Israeli peace activist working with the women's peace movement back home and doing solidarity work with the nonviolent campaign against the wall being built in Palestine. So when I come here and speak as an Israeli, I can use my accent, but usually I also have to legitimize my own speak by telling about my army experiences and my family in Israel and so on and so forth. And this is endless. So let me speak as an Israeli. As an Israeli, I am no expert on anti-Semitism, and I don't know much about anti-Semitism because where I come from, Jews are the ruling majority. But I do know that reading through Norman Finkelstein's latest book, I see again and again and again how he quotes Israeli and other human rights organizations and Israeli authors and Israeli politicians quoting again and again and again in a very meticulous research of the human rights violations against the Palestinians today. And the picture that he paints is very, very grim and very, very clear and very, very maybe confrontational, sometimes funny, but most times very sad. But on the other hand, it's not a very controversial picture in Israel, because I claim that in Israel, all of these stories of human rights violations, all of these observations and analysis of the way the occupation is extremely brutal and repressive and how it uses techniques of ethnic separation and ethnic cleansing, all of these are very known facts in Israel. The only debate that we do have is about tactics or about how to do things, so who is the naive party in the argument. So the fact that bringing these very basic information and knowledge here to the American public is so controversial is very, very distressing for me. Because as an Israeli peace activist, I want people who care about that region, who care about the peoples of Israel and Palestine, to know these things in order to make good decisions and to discuss these things in an intelligible way. And just deciding not to hear the facts is not good enough. And thank you. So I want to call upon especially the organized American Jewish communities to open up this debate. Because if whenever someone who speaks up against official Israeli government policies is labeled an anti-Semite, then according to that definition, almost all Israelis are anti-Semites. Because at least 50% of Israelis at any given time are opposed to their government's policies. Okay? So it doesn't make any sense. And we need the organized Jewish American communities, and we need the non-Jewish Americans who are involved in social justice groups and freedom actions and so on, who care about indigenous people's rights and who care about equal rights. We need them to know and we need them to act, because as things stand right now, it is exactly the American support, both economically and politically, that allows for all these things to continue, which is horrible. So in a way, I started by saying that I'm here as an Israeli in order to legitimize Dr. Finkelstein's talk today, and I want to finish by saying that it is us as Israelis, as I see it, who need such talks in order to change things and produce some kind of livable environment where I live. So I know I'm very, very curious to hear our speaker for today, and I know that you are too, so I want us to welcome Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
Okay, thank you for having me this evening. I have to dissent from one comment. You were described as braving the weather to come here. As a Chicagoan, I wish I had to brave this weather every day. The topic I'm going to speak on this evening actually was touched on in a, I think, quite eloquent manner by the person who introduced me. And the subject of my remarks tonight is going to be a kind of paradox. Namely, if you examine the historical record on the Israel-Palestine conflict or the past, if you examine the human rights record on the Israel-Palestine conflict or the present, and if you examine the diplomatic record on the Israel-Palestine conflict or the future, you find, I think, and I'll try to illustrate, you find that there's practically no controversy in that documentary record. It's remarkably straightforward. It's remarkably uncomplicated. It's remarkably uncontroversial. And yet, when you enter the public arena or the world of the media, you're told, and it seems as if, the Israel-Palestine conflict is very complicated and very controversial. And the question I'm going to address this evening is, how do you account for so much controversy swirling around a conflict which, if you look at the documentary record, is really not complicated at all? That's a large number of assumptions and a large burden of proof on me, since it seems to fly in the face of the received wisdom, at any rate in the United States, where we are told how complicated this conflict is. Let me begin my remarks with a simple illustration of the claim I'm going to argue this evening. In July 2004, the International Court of Justice, the World Court, the highest judicial body in the world, at any rate the most authoritative judicial body in the world, rendered a milestone advisory opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. The immediate concern of the World Court was the wall that Israel was building and continues to build in the occupied West Bank. But in order to judge the legality of the wall that Israel was building, the World Court had to examine a large number of topics which are often said to be the most controversial and complicated aspects of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the World Court rendered opinions on all of those allegedly complicated areas. So, for example, the World Court begins by recalling Article 2 of the United Nations Charter and the basic principle of international law that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. And from this principle, the World Court rules that Israel has no claim, can claim not even an atom of sovereignty, over the territories it occupied in the June 1967 war, that the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, and Jerusalem are what the World Court repeatedly calls in its decision occupied Palestinian territories. Put simply, this means that contrary to what we're often told, the territories Israel occupied in June 1967, they are not disputed territories. They are occupied Palestinian territories. That's the World Court's terminology, which they refer to on numerous occasions in their advisory opinion. Number two, the World Court had to rule on the question of the settlements Israel has constructed in the Gaza, at that time the Gaza and the West Bank. The World Court recalls Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits occupying powers from transferring their populations to occupied territories, and the World Court rules that all those settlements, all those 400,000 settlers in the West Bank and in the Jerusalem area, they're all illegal under international law. They constitute, as the World Court quotes it, a flagrant violation of international law. It's quite interesting. A new study just came out by an Israeli, Gershom Gorenberg, entitled The Accidental Empire. And in the study, Gorenberg points out that even Israel's legal advisor to the foreign ministry, a fellow by the name of Theodore Meron, as well as the then defense minister, Moshe Dayan, already in 1967 and 68, wrote privately that it's illegal to settle our population in the occupied territories. Once again, the question of settlements, which we're often told is a complicated and controversial question, it turns out not to be complicated or controversial at all. They are illegal or a flagrant violation of international law. Then we come to that third area, which is always deemed the most controversial, namely the status of Jerusalem. But the World Court repeats over and over again that Jerusalem is part of occupied Palestinian territory. uncomplicated. And finally, the World Court rules, the part of the opinion which most people are familiar with, the World Court rules that the wall is illegal, the wall that Israel is building, and that it's the responsibility of the international community to enforce the opinion of the World Court. Well, where does that leave us? For those of you who are familiar with the terminology of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, they refer to this phenomenon which they call the final status issues. Those are supposedly the most complicated ones, and they consist of borders, settlements, Jerusalem, and I'll get to the fourth in a moment, refugees. And we're often told that those issues have to be deferred until the end because they are so complicated. But in fact, they turn out, at any rate, judging by the World Court decision, they turn out not to be complicated at all. So far, I've told you half the story. The other half of the story is, what was the vote? The vote in the World Court was not close. It was 14-1. The only dissenting vote was that of the American judge, Thomas Bergenthal. And before people sneer at the Bergenthal negative vote, it merits noting that even Bergenthal was very cautious in his negative vote. He did not call his statement, he issued a statement, but he did not call it a dissent. He called it a declaration. And he begins his declaration by saying that, in fact, I agree with much in the majority opinion's statement on the topic. And he goes on to say, crucially, at the end of his remarks, he says, I agree. There can be no question the settlements are illegal under international law. And he says, if Israel is building the wall in order to incorporate the settlements, he says, in that case, the wall is, I'm using his expression, ipso facto illegal under international law. Well, Israel's high court has acknowledged that large parts of the wall are being built to incorporate the settlements, which means all 15 judges on the high court, on the world court, all 15 judges in the world court are in agreement on a fundamental question bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that brings us to the issue I want to discuss today. If it's true that there's practically no disagreement on what are said to be the most contentious issues in the Israel-Palestine conflict, the so-called final status issues, how do you account for all the controversy? Before I explore that question, I want to briefly ask your indulgence for some personal background. Not that my personal autobiography should be of any interest to anyone in the room. On most days, it's not of much interest to me, except as a source of depression and self-pity. However, there are aspects of it which have some relevance to my remarks at the very end, so I'll stick narrowly to the relevant aspects of my personal biography. I first became involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict in June 1982, at the time of Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Up until then, I had been fairly active politically as a teenager, but I can't say Israel and Palestine were on my radar screen. Come June 1982 and Israel's invasion, I joined with some other Jews forming a little group called Jamal, Jews Against the Israeli Massacre in Lebanon. It was and remains a horrible sounding acronym for a quite horrible little group. I used to say that after Sabra and Shatila, the second biggest catastrophe of the Lebanon War was Jamal. I hope there are no veterans in this room, and even if there were, I'm sure they would be nodding their head, yes, I agree with that. In any case, it was an intellectually stimulating environment, and one topic which came up or recurred in our discussions was, are you now or have you ever been? Now, it was not, are you now or have you ever been a communist? And I see some older people in this room to whom I think that question might apply. No, the question for us was, are you now or have you ever been a Zionist? And the truth be told, I hadn't studied the topic much, and believing, as I've always believed, that politics should be in equal parts of the mind and of the heart, I wouldn't commit myself until I had studied the topic. And I began to study this question of Zionism quite closely. After about a year, I decided that this would make as good a doctoral thesis topic as any, and I was one of those famous ABDs, all but dissertation, and I decided to make this my doctoral dissertation topic. And I studied it for, I did research for another year. We're now in 1984, and I was about to embark on the writing phase of my dissertation. And for those of you who know that experience, when you're about to embark on the writing, you look for every excuse not to do it. You've got to read one more book or one more article. You don't really have to read them, but you're dreading the prospect of trying to organize all of this material. In my case, it was I didn't have to look for a pretext because the pretext, as it were, came to me. In April 1984, I walked into a bookstore. At that time, it was called Harper and Row. Now it's the publisher HarperCollins. I walked into the Harper and Row bookstore, and on the front table, prominently displayed was this book called From Time Immemorial, The Origins of the Arab-Jewish Conflict Over Palestine. And clearly that seemed to have some relevance to my dissertation topic. I took the book off the shelf, and I did as most academics do. I turned to the back to check who was endorsing the book. Actually, most academics first turn to the index to see if they're mentioned, and then they look for the endorsements. Not to say I don't do that now. Okay. And the endorsements was a very impressive roster. At the top was the famed historian Barbara Tuchman, and she called the book, quote, a historical event in itself. And then there was the famous Nazi Holocaust scholar Lucy Dawidowicz. There was the Nobel laureate for literature, Saul Bellow, the Nobel laureate for peace, Elie Wiesel. Why he got it, nobody knows, one of those eternal mysteries, and so on and so forth. It was a very impressive list. And then very quickly, the book became a national bestseller, went into 7 hardback printings, and it got scores and scores of reviews, ranging from ecstasy to awe. The editor-in-chief and publisher of The New Republic, a fellow by the name of Martin Peretz, he said, this book, if read, will change the history of the future, whatever that means. And in fact, a few days ago, a fellow emailed me a recently declassified American document from the State Department. And the State Department wrote as follows, Joan Peters, this was from 1984, Joan Peters has written the first true account of the roots of the Middle East crisis from time immemorial, in which she definitively proves that there is no historical basis for the national ethnic concept of a Palestinian. And in fact, truth be told, if what Joan Peters wrote were true, had it been true, it would have forced us to seriously reconsider our understanding of the conflict. Because Joan Peters claimed that on the eve of Zionist colonization, Palestine was empty. The Zionist settlers came, made the desert bloom, and then all these Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously entered Palestine. They sneaked into Palestine and pretended to be indigenous. And in effect, the Palestinians, or what we call the Palestinians, had individually and collectively fabricated their genealogies. Well, a number of you are laughing at that thesis. I cannot say I counted myself among those who dismissed it. I am of the left politically, in the political camp of the left. There are not many campers left in that camp, but I remain there singing my Pete Seeger and Paul Robeson, come what may. Those applause I accept, especially for Paul Robeson. In any event, those who were of my political stripe and my political camp, they dismissed the book out of hand. They dismissed it as, oh, it's just Zionist propaganda. It happened as a young man, the age of college students, for those of you who are present here, I had very deeply held convictions which I thought were grounded in solid scholarship. The convictions I came to, I did not come to until I had done an enormous amount of reading. And anyone who disagreed with those convictions, I was very quick to dismiss them as victims of bourgeois propaganda. Now, as it happens, sometimes history is cruel, and it was quite cruel to me personally, because come the late 1970s, it turned out that many of my convictions turned out to be wrong. And it was a real, as they call it in the cliche, it was a very sobering moment for me. And it taught me a very good lesson at a very young age, to be very cautious about your opinions and to always listen to the other side, because the other side may be right. And so when the Joan Peters book came out, I must admit to having greeted it with dread, because it seemed as if, once again, I might have been fooled. And the first time was such a humiliation when I had dismissed so many people who disagreed with me as some suffering from some sort of bourgeois or petty bourgeois illness, and I turned out to be wrong, that I was not going to let that happen to me again. And so even though those around me dismissed the book as Zionist propaganda, that sounded to me like how people once before, including myself, dismissed those who we disagreed with as victims of bourgeois propaganda. And so I sat down with the book like Captain Ahab and Moby Dick. I went at the Joan Peters book. Every night when I came home from work, I would sit down with the book on my bed and try to figure out all the numbers, all the figures, and figure out how she came to her conclusions. And her conclusions, she had this very densely argued demographic study, and her conclusions were validated by the director of population studies at the University of Chicago. An appendix in her book at the end included a letter from this fellow, Philip Hauser, who said, I checked all Joan Peters' numbers, and those numbers are correct. And that was quite intimidating because demography is a fairly arcane topic. something about which I surely knew absolutely nothing. But then a voice inside of me said, I remember when, in my past, I would defer to authorities, very smart authorities, Harvard professors, and so forth, saying, well, if they say it's true, referring to my convictions, it must be true. But they turned out to be wrong. So I thought, well, maybe Philip Hauser is wrong. And I sat down, worked at the book for a quite lengthy period of time, at least I think 3 weeks. And then one night, it was 1:30 in the morning, my eyes started to water, the chill down my spine. I started to breathe heavily. Calm down. I realized that the key number in the demographic study, the key number was a fake. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an error. The way the material was organized, it was clear the number was a mistake. And it was an exhilarating moment. My good friend, the late Paul Sweezy, he later said to me, discovering a fraud is every scholar's eureka. And this was my eureka moment. I jumped out of the bed. I paced my room. I lived in a little Raskolnikov-style studio, back and forth, pumping my elbow. I did it. I did it. I did it. And in the words, in the spirit of Oprah, I wanted to share the good news. I didn't know who to do it with, but I am Jewish, so I called my mother. And it was 1:30 in the morning. I called her up. I was breathless. I said, Mom, I did it. I did it. I did it. And like a good Jewish mother, she said, I'm very proud of you. I'm very happy for you. And what did you do? And obviously, she was rather underwhelmed by my answer. I found an error in a demographic study. And then I proceeded to examine the whole book. It contained, as Joan Peters liked to boast, it contained 1,853 footnotes. And I went through those footnotes one by one, sitting in the New York City Public Library, the research branch, and it turned out that all the footnotes, the references were mangled beyond recognition. Not very sophisticated mangling, where there was a word not in a document, she put an ellipsis, dot, dot, dot. Not very clever. And before you're bedazzled by my intellectual brilliance, I have to confess that exposing the fraud was very easy. The book was so ridiculous. It was so preposterous. It took me about 6 months to produce the manuscript, which I called, I liked the original title, The Protocols of Joan Peters. It took me about 6 months to produce the manuscript. The real challenge was not documenting the hoax. The real challenge was publicizing it, because so many people of prominence had invested their names in the book and their reputations. How did it look when this book, which was a historical event in itself, which was going to change the history of the future, how did it look when this graduate student was able to figure out, after studying the topic for 2 years at most, that the book was a complete hoax? And so it took a very long time before the book was finally exposed. The main witnesses were the Israeli historian Yehoshua Porath, who eventually pronounced, he's the leading authority in the world on Palestinian nationalism, and Porath eventually pronounced the book, quote, a sheer forgery. And Anthony Lewis, the then liberal columnist for the New York Times, wrote a famous column called There Were No Indians. And that was pretty much the end of Joan Peters. until now, but that's another story which I don't have time to go into. And so, from there on in, which is now about roughly two decades, that was 1986 until now, I've devoted my entire adult political life to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And this is a milestone for me, just for me, of sorts, because two decades have elapsed, and when a milestone of this sort comes along, it's a source, it's a moment of real reflection. And one of the things I had to reflect on, or I came to reflect on, is, well, what did I learn in all these 20 years of reading quite a large amount on the subject, and to the exclusion of many subjects which I should have read on, but I, alas, never got around to doing. And the main lesson I learned, or I think the main lesson I derived from these past 20 years, is at the end of the day, the conflict really isn't very complicated. It's not really controversial at all. And if I had any doubts about that, when you look at the actual record on the subject, you discover among those who study the topic as a profession, they don't disagree on very much, if anything. So let me give you some illustrations. Let's begin with the history of the conflict. For the older people in the room, and even for those who are of younger age, probably the most contentious issue in the history of the conflict has always been, how did those Palestinians become refugees in 1948? That is to say, the origin of the Palestinian refugee question. And there used to be all very heated, very fervent debate, passionate debate, about how they became refugees. I don't have time to go through that history right now, but if you look at the scholarly record now, there's a very narrow range of disagreement and a very broad range of agreement on what used to be the most contentious question. Virtually all historians, we can say a broad consensus, agrees. Palestinians were, to quote the most authoritative Israeli scholar on the topic, Benny Morris, Palestinians were, he says, ethnically cleansed in 1948. That's not a matter of dispute any longer. Benny Morris is very far from being a leftist. And in his new art incarnation as someone considerably to the right, he doesn't retreat from that central conclusion. The Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. There is debate in the historiography. There is debate on whether it was premeditated, intentional, or whether it was the outcome of war. Professor Morris will say it was the unintentional outcome of war. Other historians will say not so. The Zionist movement was committed from fairly early on to expelling the indigenous population when the possibility occurred, namely during the war, they proceeded to do so. To give some of you a sense, or to give all of you a sense, of how uncontroversial that question has become, it's very useful to open up the recent book by Israel's former foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami. Shlomo Ben-Ami was Prime Minister Barak's foreign minister, and he was the one involved in the negotiations in 2000 with Mr. Clinton, Mr. Arafat, and Mr. Barak. Shlomo Ben-Ami just came out with a book, Oxford University Press, called Scars of War, Wounds of Peace. It came as a kind of surprise to me. Not only did he acknowledge that 48 was an ethnic cleansing, he goes one step further and situates himself with those historians who said it was premeditated. It was not an accident of war, which means even within the very narrow range of disagreement, Shlomo ben Ami puts himself in the extreme camp. Those who say it was a premeditated expulsion, or as he puts it, it was in conformity with the Zionist philosophy of transfer. That's the historical record. Let's now turn to the present. And the present basically means the human rights record. Now, the human rights record is very interesting. On the way here, I was speaking with the people who drove me over in the car, and we were talking about the Dershowitz, the book I wrote on Alan Dershowitz's book, The Case for Israel. And they asked me how I came to write the book and whether I considered it a waste of time. And I said, actually, no, because I had occasion, as a consequence of writing the book, to read through about 20 years of human rights reports. And those 20 years of human rights reports literally run now into the tens of thousands of pages, because Israel-Palestine is probably the most heavily monitored area of the world by human rights organizations. There are the international organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. There are the local organizations like B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. There's the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel. There's Physicians for Human Rights in Israel. And there are many other Israeli organizations who do a lot of monitoring and publishing on the topic. And that's leaving aside for a moment the many Palestinian human rights organizations. Now, these organizations are fiercely independent of each other, and they all have their own autonomous research staffs, field staffs, and legal staffs. And, leaving all that aside for a moment, human rights law is a relatively new branch of international law, and there are a lot of gray areas. And, leaving that aside for a moment, human rights work is often subject to the fallibilities of human judgment. What do I mean by that? A lot of human rights work consists of this. There is a demonstration. On this side are the Israelis. On this side are the Palestinians. Field workers go out to observe the demonstration. They want to see, they turn to the Israeli side. Did they initiate the clash? And if they did they fire warning shots first? And if they did they then aim at the legs? Did they aim at the torso? Did they aim at the head? And then the field worker turns to the Palestinian side. Did they initiate the clash? And if they did, were they using stones or were they using lethal weapons? And if they were using lethal weapons, were the people firing the weapons situated on the periphery of the demonstration, or were they in the heart of the demonstration? Well, as you can imagine, there's a lot of room there for human error. I'm sure many people in this room know the famous Kurosawa film, Rashomon. Several people are witness to the same incident and recall it altogether differently later on. What's very striking about the human rights literature is, as I said, I went through a 20-year period. I went through thousands and probably tens of thousands of pages. I literally was only able to find one occasion, one demonstration where two human rights organizations disagreed on one tiny point. That was it. There was just no controversy. There was no disagreement. Well, what does the human rights question look like? Obviously, it's a substantial body of literature. Let's take one issue which is very much in the news today. We're told that, over and over again, we're told that a condition for recognizing Hamas is that they must renounce terrorism, which to my mind is a perfectly legitimate demand to impose on Hamas. However, let's look at the full picture according to what human rights reports show. The number of fatalities on both sides, approximately 3,500 Palestinians have been killed since September 2000, the beginning of the second Intifada, and approximately 1,000 Israelis have been killed. On both sides, the ratio is roughly the number of civilians and bystanders killed of those 3,500 versus 1,000. The ratio is roughly 3-1. Three times as many Palestinian civilians and bystanders have been killed as Israelis have been killed. Now, some people may say that may be true, but isn't there a difference between Palestinian targeting of Israeli civilians versus Israeli killing of three times as many Palestinian civilians by accident, collateral damage? That's the argument we hear. But that's not what human rights organizations say. If you look at the Human Rights Organization findings, they state that Israel uses live ammunition indiscriminately, excessively, and on many occasions, they deliberately target civilians. B'Tselem, the most authoritative of the Israeli human rights organizations, concludes as follows. When so many civilians have been killed and wounded, the lack of intent makes no difference. Israel remains responsible. When Israel has killed so many Palestinian civilians and bystanders, the lack of intent makes no difference. In fact, as many Palestinian minors have been killed as the total number of Israeli civilians. The figure is 680. Well, what does all that mean? That is, to borrow from Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, his distinction, regardless of intent, Israel is, in effect, guilty of state terrorism. That's the only conclusion you can reach. The only differences between Israeli and Hamas terrorism are, one, Israeli terrorism is three times as lethal. And two, no demand is being put on Israel to renounce terrorism as a condition of acceptance by the international community. Those are the only differences, judging from the human rights reports. Let's turn to that last area. We looked at the past and the present. Let's look at the future. That is to say, how do you resolve the conflict? Now, we're told that's very complicated. But if you look at the international community's deliberations on the subject, it's really not very complicated at all. For the past 30 years, the international community has put forth a resolution of the conflict, which I suspect is familiar to almost everyone in this room. It's called the two-state settlement, a full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories in accordance with the principle now upheld by the World Court that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. That's the burden on Israel's side. And recognition of Israel's right to live in security and peace with its neighbors. That's the burden on the Palestinian side and the side of neighboring Arab countries. That's the two-state settlement. What is the international community's consensus on it? Not complicated. All you have to do is look at United Nations General Assembly resolutions. Take 1989. There's a vote in the General Assembly on the two-state settlement. The vote is 151-3. With no abstentions. The three dissenting votes, the United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica. That's it. If you fast forward to 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, the vote's always the same. It's the whole world on one side, the whole world on one side, and seven dissents on the other. Every year, the United States, Israel, Nauru, N-A-U-R-U, Palau, P-A-L-A-U, Tuvalu, T-U-V-A-L-U, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. That's it. Seven dissents, always, sometimes Palau drops out and Nauru comes in, but that, no, but that's really about it. Not complicated. So let's look at the international consensus and judge a second demand that's been put on Hamas. Hamas, we're told, must recognize the state of Israel as a condition of acceptance for negotiations. To my thinking, that's perfectly reasonable. Israel is a member state of the United Nations, and according to international law, it has the right to live in peace and security with its neighbors. But then we have to look at, again, the full picture. And what's the full picture? On the Israeli side, no Israeli government, no Israeli party, and no Israeli official has ever recognized the right of Palestinians to a state within the borders specified by international law, namely the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, with Jerusalem as its capital. That's the law. That's what the World Court said. But no Israeli government has ever mutually or reciprocally recognized that right to the Palestinian people. Furthermore, as this demand is being put on Hamas, what's going on de facto, not verbally, de facto? De facto, Israel's building a wall now, which will annex about 10% of the West Bank. It will annex Jerusalem. It will divide the West Bank in two. Israel's already, to quote B'Tselem, de facto annexed the Jordan Valley, is as we speak, according to B'Tselem, ethnically cleansing the Jordan Valley. The wall is going to go around the settlement area called Ariel, which means the northern part of the West Bank is going to be cut in two parts. As we speak, we're asking Hamas to verbally acknowledge Israel's existence, but Israel is de facto, not in words, it's de facto dismembering Palestine. And in any moral calculus, obviously, acts speak much louder than words. And de facto, it's not Hamas which wants to destroy Israel. De facto, it's Israel which is destroying Palestine. That's the documentary record. And now I have to go to the main part of this evening's talk, and I saw a signal I have 30 minutes to do it. I'm going to do my very best to get through to the end. The main part of this evening's talk is to repeat the thesis: if what I'm saying is true, the conflict is not controversial, then from whence all the controversy? And the main argument I'm going to make this evening is that I think most of the controversy is fabricated. It's concocted. It's artificial. Its purpose is to divert attention away from the documentary record and to sow confusion around it. Let me begin. In my view, there are two kinds of disagreements on the Israel-Palestine conflict. One kind I consider legitimate disagreement, and the rest, as I said, I consider illegitimate, fabricated, and concocted. Let me briefly look at the legitimate disagreement. The legitimate disagreement is basically a fancy way of saying issues about which I think honest people can disagree. And let's take an example. Let's take the question of the refugees, again, those 1948 Palestinian refugees. You can agree about the facts, namely they were ethnically expelled, but reach altogether different moral conclusions regarding those facts. Morality doesn't flow directly from facts. You take a person like Benny Morris, the authoritative Israeli historian on the topic. Morris says, yes, it's true, Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948, but he says, I think it was a good thing. Sometimes ethnic cleansings are good things. They're not always bad things. So he says, take the case of the United States. He said, quote, I'm using his language now, the annihilation of the native population was a good thing because it made possible the great American Republic. Or you can take someone like Professor Dershowitz from Harvard. He says that as far as I'm concerned, ethnic cleansings, he said, are, quote, fifth-rate moral issues analogous to massive urban renewal. Well, it's not a disagreement of the facts. We agree, it's ethnic cleansing. It's a disagreement over moral judgments. And you cannot say moral judgments are wrong in the same way as you could say facts are wrong. You could say these are Nazi moral judgments, and that's correct, but you can call them wrong moral judgments. Now, if we leave Mr. Dershowitz and Mr. Morris aside for the moment, and we turn to the universe of normal human beings, you can agree on the facts, agree on the moral issues, agree on the legal issues, but still reach altogether different political conclusions. Now, some of you will be a little surprised at that. How can you agree on the moral and legal questions, still reach different political conclusions? Well, let's take an example like Professor Chomsky. Professor Chomsky will say, of course, the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948. No serious historian disputes it any longer. He'll say, morally, of course, it was an abomination, as ethnic cleansings always are. And he'll say, legally, of course, they have the right of return. And it'll come as a surprise, I think, to many people in the audience, that even the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes, it's simply not a controversial question in the legal literature. Organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they all issued statements in 2000 at the time of the Camp David negotiations, and they all said the same thing. Palestinians, all the Palestinians expelled in 1948, they have a right to return to their homes. It's simply not complicated. Well, he'll agree on the factual question, the moral question, the legal question, but then he'll say, politically, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's really feasible. And he says, it's in fact very immoral to go to Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and tell people they're going to be returning home when in fact they're not. Well, I think that's a disagreement in judgment. I'm not saying he's right or he's wrong. And I'm not saying those who say they're going to return are right or wrong. Judgment is just that. You weigh factors, and people weigh the factors and reach different conclusions. For me, that's a legitimate disagreement. And it's a disagreement where people have to live to agree, you know, to agree to disagree. I don't consider either side the enemy. It's an area where there is room for different judgments. That's the area of what I, for lack of a better term, I call legitimate disagreement. As I've already said, it's rather narrow. Because on the big question, namely how to resolve the conflict, the consensus is overwhelming on the two-state settlement. Okay, that's the legitimate disagreement. How about the illegitimate disagreement. Because of reasons of time, I'm going to have to summarize it fairly quickly, but we'll have still additional moments for questions and answers, and I can fill in the details. In my opinion, there are three main areas of illegitimate disagreement or fabricated disagreement or concocted disagreement. Number one is the effort to mystify the conflict, to pretend that the Israel-Palestine conflict is so complicated that you have to have a knowledge the equivalent of rocket science to penetrate its mysteries. And we're told it's so complicated, the fancy Latin term, it's sui generis, it can't be compared to any other conflict. The purpose of this mystification of the Israel-Palestine conflict, this claim that it's about a cosmic clash of civilizations, a cosmic clash of religions, and so forth, the purpose of this mystification of the conflict is pretty straightforward. Number one, it's to get the observer to suspend his ordinary moral impulses or her ordinary moral judgments. So, we're told, well, Israel is systematically torturing Palestinian detainees. Israel systematically imposes collective punishment on Palestinians. Israel was the only country in the world to legalize hostage taking. And then we'll say, yes, that's true, but you see, you don't really understand. It's more complicated than that. And what seems wrong on the surface, if you really understood the conflict, you would understand that it's not really wrong. But you don't understand the Israel-Palestine conflict. If you understood its complexities, what seems wrong actually really isn't wrong. That's one purpose of mystifying it. And the other purpose is pretty straightforward. You're always told with the Israel-Palestine conflict, do not compare. It's unique. Don't make comparisons. And the reason why is pretty obvious. Because if you start making comparisons, Israel comes out on the wrong side of the analogies. So if you compare Israel and Palestine, the history, to what happened to Native Americans in North America, an analogy which in fact works quite well, and I once wrote a fairly lengthy manuscript on the topic, Israel comes out on the wrong side of the analogy. So do not compare. Or if you make another obvious analogy between the situation now in the occupied territories with apartheid under South Africa, well, again, Israel comes out on the wrong side of the analogy. So you're told, do not compare. It's one of the peculiarities of the Israel-Palestine conflict that so much of we're told you're not allowed to compare is often compared in Israel. For example, the apartheid analogy. You can barely open an Israeli paper without someone commenting on one side or another of the analogy. You take the case of B'Tselem, Israel's leading human rights organization. It writes regarding the occupied territories, Israel has created in the occupied territories a regime of separation based on discrimination, applying two separate systems of law in the same area, and basing the rights of individuals on their nationality. This regime is the only one of its kind in the world, and is reminiscent of distasteful regimes from the past, such as the apartheid regime in South Africa. And you constantly come across statements like that, whether it's by Israelis, like Shulamit Aloni, a former member of the Israeli Knesset, or B'Tselem, or from John Dugard, who's considered the father of human rights law in South Africa, or Archbishop Desmond Tutu, That statement constantly, that comparison constantly reappears. But here we're told, do not compare. Do not compare because Israel comes out on the wrong side. It's a striking fact, incidentally, that one of the persons who made the comparison was none other than Ariel Sharon. He was reported to have stated that the model he was looking at for the occupied territories were the Bantustans in South Africa. But here we're told, do not compare. We shouldn't compare because it's different. It's more complicated. Is it really different? Is it more complicated? Let's look at the record. I don't have time now to go through the British record on Palestine. Let's just look briefly at the what Israelis say. Take the case of that fellow, Benny Morris, who I mentioned earlier. In his standard history of the Israel-Palestine conflict entitled Righteous Victims, at some point he has to ask the question, well, why don't these Arabs like Zionism? And his answer is pretty straightforward. He says, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Well, some of you are wondering, why did I repeat that statement? What's so profound about it? But when I read it, it kind of leapt off the page for me, and not because I was in the hallucinogenics. Because notice what Morris doesn't say. He doesn't say the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism was anti-Semitism. He doesn't say it was hatred of Jews. He doesn't say it's fear of Enlightenment ideas. He doesn't say it's fear of the emancipation of women. No, it's pretty straightforward. They opposed Zionism because they feared territorial dispossession and displacement, a fear which, as it turns out, was quite rational, not very complicated. What's odd about the Israel-Palestine conflict is these explanations that we hear in regard to the Israel and Palestine, were they used anywhere else, they would be received with ridicule. So let's take the case of North America. The Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment, it was a very bloody affair. We shouldn't be so politically correct as to forget Native Americans killed men, they killed women, they killed children. It wasn't altogether incorrect to say they were savages, although those who were killing them also behaved savagely. And they were, fairly enough, yesterday's terrorists. But, how would any of us react if a professor at Santa Cruz would come on television and say that the chief motor of Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment, the chief motor was anti-Europeanism or anti-Christianism or anti-whiteism? You would laugh. You don't need these exotic explanations. It happens to be the obvious explanation, to paraphrase Benny Morris, the fear of territorial displacement and dispossession, the obvious explanation happens to be a sufficient one. It really isn't that complicated. The second kind of mystification of the conflict is the playing of the Holocaust card, the dragging in of the Nazi Holocaust in order to divert attention from the real issues in the conflict. I don't have time now to go into the playing of the Nazi Holocaust card. I don't have time right now. I'll just make the main point that the central contribution of the Holocaust industry which began shortly after the June 1967 war, the central contribution of the Holocaust industry was to conjure up this notion of what's called Holocaust uniqueness. That is to say, no other people in the history of humanity have ever suffered the way Jews suffered during the Nazi Holocaust. As an intellectual doctrine, it's completely vacuous, and as a moral doctrine, it's a complete abomination, this ranking of human suffering. But politically, it served a very useful purpose, and the purpose was, if you can prove or seem to prove that Jews suffered uniquely during the Nazi Holocaust, then Jews are entitled to special moral dispensations. You can't apply the same standards to them because their suffering was unique. And that was basically what the Holocaust industry started to do, to claim that we can't apply the ordinary standards of international law and human rights when it came to the Israel-Palestine conflict because of the Holocaust. The most recent version of this Holocaust, playing of the Holocaust card, is what's called the new anti-Semitism, the claim that there's been a massive resurgence of anti-Semitism in the mainstream of European and North American life. And I'm sure most of you in this room have seen the raft of books and the unending number of newspaper or magazine articles on what's called the new anti-Semitism. Once again, I don't have time to go through it in detail, just the basic facts. Number one, this claim of a new anti-Semitism is not new. And number two, it has nothing whatever to do with anti-Semitism. Every 15 or so years, the claim is thrown around of a new anti-Semitism. And the purpose is always the same, namely whenever Israel comes under pressure to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict diplomatically, or whenever it faces a public relations debacle, the new anti-Semitism extravaganza is started up again. 1974, the heads of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, for those of you who don't know, it's the so-called main Jewish defense organization. Its main responsibility is defaming the character of anyone who criticizes Israel. The ADL publishes a book called, you can check it in, I'm sure the Santa Cruz Library has it, by two fellows named Arnold Forster and Benjamin Epstein. It's called The New Anti-Semitism. 1981, the new heads of the ADL, Nathan Perlmutter and his wife Ruth Ann Perlmutter, they put out a book called The Real Anti-Semitism, the main thesis being there is a new anti-Semitism. And again in 2000, the ADL and its kindred organizations began to put out these claims about a new anti-Semitism. The purpose was pretty straightforward. Number one, to turn the perpetrators and their apologists into the victims. So instead of the real suffering of Palestinians in the occupied territories, we were supposed to focus our attention and concern on the alleged suffering of Jews in Israel and outside the state of Israel in Europe and North America. And the second purpose, which was also pretty straightforward, was to discredit any critics of Israel and critics of Israeli policy by accusing them of being anti-Semitic. Is there any evidence for a new anti-Semitism? Let me just clarify one point, because there's always confusion on this issue. Nobody's denying whether or not anti-Semitism exists in the world. Of course it does. But that's not the claim of these people who speak about a new anti-Semitism. If you read their publications, they claim, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, CNN, CBS, ABC, the London Guardian, Jewish feminists, they're all anti-Semitic. They're not talking about fringe groups. They're claiming that the mainstream of European and North American life is filled, replete with anti-Semitism. Amnesty International, anti-Semitic. Human Rights Watch, anti-Semitic. Is there any evidence for this? If you go through the record, and I think I go through it fairly carefully in a book I've just written, there's no evidence at all of a new anti-Semitism. There's no evidence of it in North America, and in fact, there's no evidence of it in Europe. Without going through all the statistics, which time doesn't allow, let's take a basic statistic. Most of you know the Pew Charitable Trusts and the Pew Surveys as being the main survey organization in the United States, the PEW, Pew Surveys. They hear all this talk about a new anti-Semitism. They go to Europe in 2003, do their surveys. What's their conclusion? Their conclusion is not only is there no evidence of a new anti-Semitism, they conclude, in fact, as compared to the last time they did the survey, there was less anti-Semitism than ever in Europe. Those are the facts, and they conclude what every rational observer knows. The main problem in Europe is not anti-Semitism, but anti-Muslim and anti-Arab sentiment. That's quite pervasive. Let me now, in the concluding remarks, I think I have approximately 8 minutes, look at, in many ways, the most dispiriting kind of conjured up, fraudulent disagreement about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that is the vast proliferation of fraud and hoaxes on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, as a matter of, as a general principle, you know, there's a lot of fraud and a lot of nonsense put out on any topic in a given week. I think it's a fair estimate that probably 70% of what we read in the web, you know, ranges somewhere between lunacy and crackpottery. The other 30% has more or less scientific value. So to claim that there's an awful lot of fraud and nonsense put out in the Israel-Palestine conflict is in itself not saying much. What makes it different, however, and in my opinion rather unique, is that when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, the fraud, the nonsense, it's validated by mainstream respected institutions. Well, I began my remarks with the Joan Peters hoax, and now I'll end my remarks for the evening with a, I think, comparable example. And I'd like to illustrate how it works, this strange phenomenon of sheer nonsense, sheer fraud, being validated in mainstream life in the United States. How does it work? Well, anyone who's in academia or around academia knows we have our sort of methods of quality control, which more or less keep people honest. How do they work? Remind me of your name. Your last name?
Baum.
So Professor Baum sees me in the street. She says, you know, Professor Finkelstein, I heard your lecture last night, and I just read a book which proves that everything you said, or most of what you said, is nonsense. Because, in fact, according to the book I read, Israel's human rights record in the occupied territories is generally superb. At that remark, like a typical academic, my eyes squint, and with a mixture of sarcasm, pitiful attempts at wit, and irony, I say, oh, really, Professor Baum? Generally superb. And now I try to cut her down a notch, two or three, by going through those mechanisms of quality control. And the first thing I say to Professor Baum, I say to her is, who published that book? Because there's a range of publications. On one end is what's called the vanity presses, where you pay to get your own book published. And at the other end is basically, the higher end is the university presses, which have a policy of what's called peer review. That is to say, experts in the field have to give a thumbs up or down on the manuscript. So I asked Professor Baum, who published that book? She's not fazed at all. She says, who published it? John Wiley and Sons. Well, I have to grant, that's an impressive publisher. No question about it. Can't dispute it. So now I turn to that second method of quality control. I say, okay, Professor Baum, who blurbed that book? Who wrote the comments on the back? Every academic does that. And she's not fazed at all. She says, who blurbed it? Well, Henry Louis Gates from Harvard blurbed it. And Floyd Abrams, the leading First Amendment expert in the United States, he blurbed it. Well, that certainly put me in my place. And so I turn to the third method of quality control. And I ask Professor Baum, what kinds of reviews did the book get? She says, reviews. The book got excellent reviews. Got an excellent review in the Boston Globe. Got an excellent review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. And that review was written by the Times' own resident expert on the Israel-Palestine conflict, a fellow named Ethan Bronner. Well, those are excellent reviews and authoritative ones. Ethan Bronner, he's the one who writes all the New York Times editorials on the Israel-Palestine conflict. He's their expert. I don't have much argument against that. So then I turn to the final, my ultimate weapon. Okay, Professor Baum, who wrote that book? Well, she's not in the least intimidated by that question. Who wrote it? She asks rhetorically. Who wrote it? The Felix Frankfurter Chair of Law at Harvard Law School. The senior most professor at Harvard Law, Alan Dershowitz. And in fact, she's correct. The book got an excellent publisher, excellent blurbs, excellent reviews. The academic pedigree of the author cannot be surpassed. Senior most chair at Harvard Law School, and yet, the book is, from start to finish, from beginning to end, a complete hoax. Now, there is, to use my terminology from earlier on, there is a narrow range of disagreement. Some people think the hoax begins with the first word on the first page. Other people believe it begins with the first name of the author's name on the cover of the book. I happen to be of the second camp. Now, the book is such a preposterous hoax, that the first two chapters are plagiarized from Joan Peters's From Time Immemorial. I kind of found that funny, that the senior most professor at Harvard Law, he not only plagiarizes, which is a fairly commonplace at Harvard Law School, but he plagiarized a hoax. I'm going to leave off with just two comments. Number one, as I said earlier on, just as in the Joan Peters case, it was not difficult to prove Dershowitz's book was a hoax. It was so preposterous, so silly, that it was very easy to juxtapose what mainstream human rights organizations have to say against what Dershowitz has to say. That was fairly straightforward and didn't pose a challenge. The challenge was getting the findings published. because Professor Dershowitz began a huge campaign to suppress publication of the book. The campaign went to the most powerful law firm in the country, or reputed to be Cravath, Swain, and Moore, to suppress publication of the book. He then went to the Terminator, Governor Schwarzenegger of California, to suppress publication of the book because it came out from UC Press, University of California Press. And in the end, he failed in his efforts. The book was published. That may seem like a silver lining in everything I've had to say. In fact, I think it was a very mixed victory. The book came out in August, and to date, meaning up till as we speak now, 6 months later, there has not been one single review in the mainstream press in the U.S. Not one. Not one. There hasn't been, honestly, you search hard for analogies, there hasn't been this level of party unity and discipline since the days of the glorious leader Enver Hoxha of People's Albania. It's really awesome. I tried hard to find any other comparison. The only other comparison I could find was the party unity and discipline at the 1938 meeting of Stalin's Central Committee. And the only reason there was such unity then was because he killed everyone at the 1937 meeting. It's impressive. Now, it seems like a depressing picture. Somebody wants me to stop, and I'm going to stop. But I'm going to stop on an upbeat note, not because I think it's required, because I'm a person of the left, to stop on an upbeat note. But I do believe amidst all the doom and all the gloom, there really is grounds for optimism. Now, how can there be optimism after that talk? Well, there is, and I want you to listen carefully. It'll take me 30 seconds. The optimism is this. Professor Dershowitz, he devotes a large chunk of his book to documenting Israel's human rights record, claiming it's generally superb. But never once, not once, literally not once, does he cite any mainstream human rights organization, not Amnesty, not Human Rights Watch, not B'Tselem, never cites any of them. Not because he doesn't want to, of course he wants to, would add credibility. He doesn't cite them because he can't. He can't because you cannot reach the conclusion Israel's human rights record is generally superb by citing these organizations. You can only conclude that the record is generally abysmal. What does that tell us? It tells us that the human rights organizations, they're on our side. The World Court, it's on our side. The United Nations, it's on our side. World opinion, it's on our side. The bottom line is, and it's not trivial, truth is on our side. Justice is on our side. And if we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice, they may have a lot of power, and they may have a lot of money, and they may be ruthless, and it may terrify some of us that they even have the Sentinel on their side. But we have two very powerful weapons on our side. We have truth on our side. We have justice on our side. And I preserve the ideals of my youth, a lot of things I had to forego as I got older. But I will not ever give up on the hope, which I think is born in history and not just in my mind, that if we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice, notwithstanding their power, their money, and their ruthlessness, we can still win. Thank you. let's get started.